Good evening. China says it'll step in to support WHO if the U.S. bows out. Is peace still possible for Afghanistan? A nuclear disaster waiting to happen on the Columbia River, and Trump doesn't seem to care. And summer school goes ahead in New York City. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Tuesday, May 19th, 2020. As the world enters into its fourth month battling the insidious and deadly SARS-CoV-19 virus that's infected more than 4.7 million people and killed more than 315,000, world leaders have been called upon to lay out their plans for combating the virus spread. The leader of China, Xi Jinping, told the World Health Assembly on Monday that China would dispatch doctors and medical supplies to Africa and other countries in the developing world. He spoke through a translator.
The virus is still raging, and more must be done to bring it under control. To this end, I want to make the following proposals. First, we must do everything we can for COVID-19 control and treatment. This is the most urgent task. We must always put the people first, for nothing in the world is more precious than people's lives. We need to deploy medical expertise and critical supplies to places where they are needed the most. We need to take a strong step in such key areas as prevention, quarantine, detection, treatment, and tracing. We need to move as fast as we can to curb the global spread of the virus and do our best to stem cross-border transmission. We need to step up information sharing. We also need to continue supporting global research by scientists on the source and the transmission routes of the virus. Second, the World Health Organization should lead the global response. Under the leadership of Dr. Tedros, WHO has made a major contribution in leading and advancing the global response to COVID-19. At this critical juncture, to support WHO is to support international cooperation and the battle for saving lives as well.
Beijing said it would also donate $2 billion towards fighting the coronavirus. The contribution, to be spent over 2 years, amounts to more than twice what the United States had been giving the WHO before President Trump cut off American funding last month. The World Health Organization's head, Tedros Adhanom, said today he would keep leading the global fight against the coronavirus pandemic, even after U.S. President Donald Trump threatened to cut off funding and quit the body. Meanwhile, in the United States, public health officials in some states are being accused of bungling infection statistics or even deliberately using a little sleight of hand to make things look better than they really are. In Florida, the data scientist who developed the state's coronavirus dashboard, Rebecca Jones, said this week that she was fired for refusing to manipulate data to, in her words, drum up support for the plan to reopen. Guidelines from the Trump administration say that before states begin reopening, they should see a 14-day downward trend in infections. However, some states have reopened when infections are still climbing or had plateaued. The United States has recorded 1.5 million confirmed infections and over 90,000 deaths. In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo said today that a new mystery inflammatory illness affecting children exposed to SARS-CoV-19 virus might be just the tip of the iceberg. He also said officials were surprised to learn that most new cases were not among essential workers, but people at their home in their own communities.
On the new COVID cases, which surprised me, frankly, the new COVID cases that are coming in the door, about the 300 per day, those are basically infections coming from people who are at home and not working, which was shocking to me. I thought they were going to be essential workers who were out there every day being exposed to people. They're not. They're people who are at home. So it's more of a community spread. That's why the personal behavior is so important. They're not getting it on a train or a bus or as an essential worker. They're getting it at home, talking to someone on a park bench, leaving their apartment building. That's where they're getting it.
In New York City, Mayor de Blasio echoed Cuomo's warnings about new ways the COVID-19 disease is spreading and sounded the alarm about a diminishing city blood supply.
We need to make sure our hospitals, our healthcare providers, have the blood supply that they need. Normally, honestly, this is something that year in, year out, the blood supply is secure, it's strong. We've really not had a situation like this before. I've talked to a lot of our health leaders and they don't remember anything like this, but it stands to reason. We've never had an economic shutdown before. And a huge amount of the blood supply came from corporate blood drives, blood drives by different organizations, charitable civic organizations, government agencies typically would do a blood drive. So all of that's been cut off and disrupted. Therefore, the blood supply has gotten lower than we ever could have imagined. Now, we're going to put additional safeguards in place going forward to make sure that we don't have this kind of situation again, and we're encouraging all New Yorkers who can give blood to do so right away. We started talking about this a couple of days ago. So far, 2,500 New Yorkers have made appointments to give blood just in the last few days. That's a great start. That's going to help a lot. But I want to see thousands more come forward. I'm going to do it myself. I want to see thousands come forward to give blood to make sure our hospitals have what they need. So all sorts of times I've heard New Yorkers say they want to help in this crisis, and I believe you and so many good people doing so much to help their fellow New Yorker. If you can give blood, this is a good moment to give back to the city. This is absolutely a reason to travel. To go and give blood, you're doing a great public service for your fellow New Yorker.
The mayor said folks wanting to donate blood could contact the New York Blood Center at nybc.org, that's nybc.org, or call 800-933-2566, that's 800-933-2566 to make an appointment to donate blood. And New York City School Chancellor Richard Carranza laid out his plan for distance learning summer school today. The plan will provide up to 6 weeks of school for 180,000 elementary, high school, and disabled students this summer.
For our students in grades 3 through 8, summer learning will take place 4 days a week for a total of 6 weeks. This will either be on a required or recommended basis, and that is because teachers will make the determination based on each student's full year of progress. As always, as a school year closes, teachers will look closely at each individual student to determine whether they have met grade level standards, and this year they will take into account any challenges they've experienced in the past couple of months during the pandemic. Summer learning will be geared towards academic success in the fall. As the mayor has spoken on many times, this needs to be the greatest academic year in our history, and this will ensure that we have a running start to that. Summer learning will be geared towards the academic success of students who need additional supports to meet standards, and they will receive those additional supports over the summer. Teachers will communicate with families whether their student is required to participate in summer learning in order to be promoted in August, or recommended to participate to ensure they've achieved mastery of the standards. Students will also have check-ins with guidance counselors so that someone is always keeping a pulse on how they are doing in this remote learning environment. And it's summer, so we'll be incorporating things that students enjoy into the virtual experience, including social-emotional learning activities and virtual field trips. For our high schoolers, the schedule for summer learning will be 5 days per week for a total of 6 weeks. Students will have up to 5 hours of instruction daily in subjects they received a course in progress mark for, or if they failed in a prior semester. For students with disabilities, our students with 12-month individual education plans will receive instruction and related services 5 days a week for a total of 6 weeks. Students will also get daily instruction and related services that are aligned to their individual education plan and remote learning plan. This obviously has been a constantly evolving situation, but there's one thing that hasn't wavered for a moment, and that is that the City of New York is focused on accelerating learning and making sure that all students stay on track for continued success the next academic year.
New York City School Chancellor Richard Carranza. Addressing the issue of the digital divide between poor and privileged students, Carranza says the city has delivered 284,000 iPads to students across the city and has more than 5,000 en route. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In more national news, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Jerome Powell, appeared before the Senate Banking Committee, which is looking into the $2.2 trillion CARES Act passed to counter the economic collapse that followed on the heels of the COVID-19 pandemic. It was the first public update on the federal stimulus that sent $1,200 checks to American taxpayers, among other measures. Meeting remotely, Powell said Congress may have to authorize additional spending to prevent long-term damage to the economy.
The scope and speed of this downturn are without modern precedent, significantly worse than any recession since World War II. We're seeing a severe decline in economic activity and employment, and already the job gains from the last decade have been reversed. Well, more than 20 million people have lost their jobs, and recent Fed research shows that what others have also found, that people earning less are the ones being hardest hit. This reversal of economic fortune has caused a level of pain that is hard to capture in words, as lives are upended amid great uncertainty about the future. The Federal Reserve is committed to using our full range of tools to support the economy in this challenging time. Our actions so far fall into four categories. First, outright purchases of treasuries and agency mortgage-backed securities to restore functionality in these critical markets. Second, liquidity and funding measures, including discount window measures, expanded swap lines with foreign central banks, and several treasury-backed facilities to support smooth money market function. Third, with additional treasury backing, facilities to more directly support the flow of credit to households, businesses, and state and local governments. Fourth, temporary regulatory adjustments to encourage and allow banks to expand their balance sheets to support household and business customers. At the Fed, we're committed to transparency, particularly in deploying our emergency powers. Public faith in our operations depends on that transparency.
And that's Jerome Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve Board. The hearing came a day after a panel appointed by Congress reported none of the $46 billion allocated for loans and loan guarantees for the airline industry has been spent. And a little of the $500 billion program for loans to local and state governments has been dispersed by the Federal Reserve Board. In world news, on Monday, President Trump declared the United States had never really fought to win in Afghanistan during most of the two-decade-long war. In a series of tweets, the president pushed back against a Wall Street Journal editorial cautioning against abrupt decisions about the Central Asian nation. 2,300 U.S. troops have died in Afghanistan and over 110,000 Afghan civilians. In a recent incident, gunmen opened fire in a mosque in central Afghanistan, killing at least 7 worshippers and wounding 5 others. Today is the last day of Eid, when Muslims break their month-long fast. It's one of the most important observances in Islam. Trump has said he wants to pull the last U.S. forces there out and has been negotiating with the Taliban, America's primary enemy. But according to Professor Junaid Ahmad of the National Defense University, speaking to WBAI from Islamabad, Pakistan, the U.S. is not leaving as a victor in a war it could never win.
The infamous Afghan papers, almost like the Pentagon Papers of the 1970s, revealing the massive kind of corruption, the lies, the fabrications of various officers and generals, U.S. generals in Afghanistan, saying that the war is going great, the Taliban are losing ground, etc., and which turned out to be all lies. The war was not going great, and the Taliban were only gaining ground. And so I think that that conclusion had been reached, which is why these periodic negotiations that the U.S. had been having with the Taliban for quite a while, not just over the past few weeks or months, but for years, concretized these past about 2-3 weeks ago. And they actually signed a peace agreement. And they actually got the head of the Taliban to write an op-ed piece in the New York Times to tell them what they wanted. And it's been the same demand that we know for years, and that is that they want all foreign troops, all U.S. NATO troops out of Afghanistan before they kind of negotiate with any of the other forces in Afghanistan. They will not negotiate under foreign occupation. The U.S. effectively agreed to that demand. They, I think, had a timetable around 14 months of a gradual withdrawal, so on. Now, what has ensued has been I don't want to say record level of violence, because there's been violence throughout the two decades, but there's been a spate of violence which is just not explicable in terms of the Taliban wanting to engage in such wanton acts of aggression against either the U.S. troops or the Afghan government. So there is strong suspicion that both the Afghan government and its closer ally now, maybe even closer than the United States, New Delhi, the Indians and Indian intelligence are carrying out some of these attacks and blaming them on the Taliban in order to prevent the United States from leaving Afghanistan.
The Department of Justice said that a terrorist attack that happened on a military base by a Saudi soldier who was part of a U.S. Program for bringing Saudi soldiers for training in the United States was tied to Al-Qaeda. If the Taliban comes back into power, that you'll see Afghanistan again become a center for somewhat effective terrorist attacks against the United States, a dangerous thing to the U.S. Is that really a possibility here? Is that, are we back to those days again now if the U.S. pulls out?
No. This is the principal function of the kind of propaganda and the narrative that's trying to be engineered by the Afghan government along with the Indian government. What's actually been going on in Afghanistan is that the Taliban have been fighting on multiple fronts, not just the U.S. occupation or the Afghan government, but in fact, over the past several years, their principal fight has been against these ISIS-Daesh fighters that who have lost ground in Iraq and Syria, have now come south into Afghanistan and into Pakistan as well. They have been fighting against them primarily, and thankfully winning against them. For example, there was an attack on a Sikh temple in Afghanistan. It's what the current Pakistani government has been doing over the past year, and been precisely rebuilding, renovating, opening up the Sikh temples, allowing Sikhs coming from India to come. It was discovered that it was some ISIS fighter, quote unquote, from Kerala in India that actually conducted the attack. Observers cannot see any interest for the Taliban right now to be engaged in violence against anyone, really, against the government or U.S. occupation forces. One of the issues, of course, was that the Afghan government also felt highly ignored and marginalized from this entire peace process, which was just taking place between the United States and the Taliban. But the fact remains, it knows that it cannot survive without U.S. forces in the country protecting it. And it also knows many of the other ethnic leaders and warlords, including from the Shia Hazara community, have now joined the ranks of the Taliban. There seems no plausible explanation why the Taliban would want to engage in this right after signing the agreement and getting the demands that they want.
Is this part of India's, the move towards this, Hindu nationalism movement of Modi?
Oh, absolutely. I think that this is certainly an extension of it. I think that it began before the more intensification of the right-wing Hindu nationalism in India, because effectively after 9/11 and the invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. has always had a very fragile relationship with Pakistan and has depended on India in terms of the Indian presence in Afghanistan. The Indians have more consulates in Afghanistan than the Pakistanis do.
There was also the feeling a lot of women that there was going to be a real they're going to go back on whatever advances women have made in Afghanistan. Are these things we have to fear?
There seems to be a lot of changes. That's not to say that, particularly on the question of women, how much their position will have changed in terms of the women's education, women's employment. We just know that we have a situation of ongoing violence that is now, not just since the U.S. invasion of 2001, but we're literally talking about four decades of ongoing violence in the country. And I think that the priority for most Afghans at this point is how to just try to get the violence to stop and to then think about all of the other issues that certainly are pressing for that very poor country.
Professor Junaid Ahmad of the National Defense University in Islamabad, Pakistan. Last February, the Trump administration zeroed out the budget for a key cleanup project at a nuclear weapons site on the Columbia River in Washington. Hanford was the place where most of the plutonium was made to fuel America's massive nuclear weapons stockpile. The weapons left behind 56 million gallons of nuclear waste. The head of Hanford Challenge, a watchdog working with whistleblowers, is Tom Carpenter. He says Trump's budget cuts at Hanford is the work of a madman.
The latest move was to cut a huge amount of money, hundreds of millions of dollars from the cleanup budget. And everybody who watches Hanford, I'm including even the people in the Tri-Cities who generally like Trump and like what he's doing, were shocked when he zeroed out some of the cleanup budgets for some very high stakes nuclear cleanups that were supposed to be happening this year, next year, and the year after. The fact that he's proposing these kind of cuts demonstrates where his head is at, and we're at great risk here in the Northwest as a result of these decisions.
What is the problem with these cutbacks?
You know, Hanford is the worst contaminated nuclear facility in the nation, and really in the Western Hemisphere. It's got these very large inventories of nuclear materials left over from making plutonium for America's nuclear arsenal. We had 9 reactors pumping out highly radioactive materials for 45 years. You could have a release, you could have a fire, an explosion, or just simply go into the river. The result of that would be widespread contamination of the kind that we saw in Ukraine at the Chernobyl site or in Japan at Fukushima, where you've got hundreds of square or thousands of square miles off limits forever, essentially.
What specific things did he try and is his Department of Energy not going to clean up that are dangerous?
One of the top issues at Hanford is this assemblage of what are called cesium-137 and strontium-90 capsules in an area called the B plant. These materials were taken out of these underground nuclear waste tanks in 1970. And put into these big swimming pools. Just imagine 6 or so very large Olympic-sized swimming pools. The cesium-137 and the strontium-90 is a highly radioactive material. And they behave in the environment in a very peculiar way. Cesium-137 behaves like potassium. Strontium-90 behaves like calcium. It's readily absorbed by living organisms, including people, into where those elements would go if you ate or breathed in. Because of that, they're highly, highly dangerous materials and dangerous. We measure radioactivity in curies. And the permissible level of cesium-137 in a liter of water is 7 trillionths of a curie. That's T-R-I, trillionths of a curie. And you've got maybe 70 million curies of strontium-90 and cesium in these old pools that were built in the 70s. The high radiation has affected the integrity of the concrete in the pools. They're acknowledged to be not earthquake worthy and is considered to be the number one risk in the whole complex. A few percent of this cesium or strontium-90 escaping from this facility, it's like a Quonset hut, it would be a national disaster. A few percent.
What has Trump cut back on this?
Cut back the cleanup on it. We managed to get this at the top of the agenda for cleanup. They're going to remove all those capsules from the pools and put them in what's called dry cask storage. We're all enthusiastic about this. They were making progress toward making that happen beginning next year. Zeroed out. They're stopping the work on it. I think Congress is going to come in and say, hey, wait, you can't do that. And restore that funding, but we don't know. And it may be another budget cycle before funding is restored for it. It's just insane that you would take that kind of risk. And that's just one out of many, many other highly dangerous cleanups that need to happen today, that need to be on track.
Warning of this? Did you get any warning from the president about this or from the Department of Energy? Terrible budget crunch, COVID-19, something like that? Nothing.
This was an announcement made in February before COVID-19 hit. So this isn't because of COVID. This is simply Trump and his administration not understanding the severe consequences of their actions.
What happens next? What are you going to do about it?
We set up a huge hue and cry about this. Our own delegation from Congress understands well what's happening. And I think Trump is just seen in Congress at this point as crazy on some of this stuff. And I think that funding will get restored, but not without some effort and not without a hue and cry.
And that's Tom Carpenter, the head of Hanford Challenge, a watchdog group in Washington. Hanford was closed down in 1987 as the Soviet Union imploded and most nuclear weapons testing was phased out. And finally, Malcolm X would have turned 95 today. The African-American revolutionary leader became radicalized in prison, went on to preach a message of black empowerment in Harlem. He became a revolutionary after his break with the Nation of Islam. He was assassinated in 1965. His memory still motivates radically minded people fighting for justice to this very day. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, May 19th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.